I'm John Leo, editor of Minding the Campus, and I'm here today with Professor Andrew Hacker, a well-known sociologist and public intellectual and author of many excellent reviews in the New York Review of Books. And he's also the author of last year, I guess 2010, right?
That's correct.
Book Higher Education, which has a question mark at the end, meaning, is this really higher education? Now, when I asked you what you wanted to talk about, Andrew, you said, don't blame the students. What do you mean by that?
Very simply, whenever you talk with professors, as often as not, they will complain about how students are indolent, indifferent, and not ready, willing to accept their assignments. And Claudia and I, on the basis of our experience, observations, feel that is absolutely wrong.
Now, in your book, you have a broad array of criticisms of the modern university: cost, tenure, dependence on contingent faculty. Which of those factors would you like to concentrate on today?
I'd like to concentrate on, well, John, my colleagues, the faculty, the professors, because I feel that they are simply letting down today's students.
How so?
First of all, as we know, tremendous emphasis on research. Professors are judged by their publications, how much they weigh, whatever. And what they do is, when they do teach, they bring their research interests, which can be very esoteric, into the classroom. Say, you know, the minor works of William Faulkner, you know, or even the use of semicolons of William Faulkner. And then the professors get dismayed when the students aren't entranced by that kind of thing.
My favorite is The Thinness of the Elizabethan Lyric, 1605 to 1607. Now, how many kids are going to take that course?
Well, not many, I'm afraid. We have something. We have the phrase called the liberal arts. And liberal arts, I don't like the phrase general education. Let's take it seriously, liberal arts. I really think that young people, and this is on the basis of my teaching too, are curious. They want to know about the world. But it has to be put, not dumbed down, but put in terms that they understand, they can follow, and they want to follow up on.
Do you think that the professors who bring their specialized attention to the class are really helping to kill liberal arts for the kids?
I think they are. In fact, it's bad wine in the old bottles. The bottle says liberal arts, but it's not really. It's what I've called these esoteric specialties. And by the way, professors increasingly, say if we take the elite colleges, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, and even Amherst and Williams, professors get sabbaticals. Here's a question, John. How often is a sabbatical? Question. Well, most people say sabbatical every 7 years. No. At the schools I mentioned, the professors get every third year off. Which means, hey, if you're a senior, your thesis advisor is off in Padua.
Right. That's a factor. Now, in one of your essays years ago, I think you mentioned that it seemed like Berkeley had two colleges on one campus, that one of the colleges had whites and Asians and the other had black and Hispanics. Do you recall that reference?
Yes, I was writing, as you said, for the New York Review book about affirmative action,
And is that still true, and does it bother you?
Well, first of all, at Berkeley, there are far fewer black and Hispanic students because the voters of California tossed out affirmative action. That's happened in a couple of other states also, Michigan and the state of Washington. And as a result, black and Hispanic students tend more to be at, shall we say, second-tier campuses like Santa Cruz, Riverside, Irvine, where the competition is not as stiff. Now Berkeley is a, well, by the way, you do know, let's go down to UCLA for a moment. At UCLA, Asians outnumber white students.
I think it's 40% now.
Right. Do you know what UCLA now stands for?
No.
I'll tell you. Unhappy Caucasians lost among Asians.
I see. Let's let that go by. And now at the second-tier universities in California, is it still true that blacks and Hispanics are isolated or doing worse than the whites and Asians? My impression is not, but what do you think?
No, I don't get that. Oh, first of all, when it comes to the Asian students, nobody can beat them. I mean, you and I, John, I know this is a podcast, people can't see us, but you and I belong to the pink race. You know, we're really rather pale people. And we were all often thought we are the apotheosis of culture and civilization.
You mean we're not?
Afraid not. If you take the tests that we invented, the SAT, mm-hmm. the Asians just run all rings around us. Just let me add one thing. Have you heard that women aren't as good at math as men?
I heard that, yeah.
You've heard that. Well, actually, Asian women do better on the SAT than white guys.
Uh-oh. No one told me that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, listen, let's talk a bit about your book. The Higher Education with a Question Mark must have come as a shock to a lot of your readers, because most of the books criticizing the university today come from the right, and you're a man of the left. Was that surprising to your readers and to people who follow your work?
I'm afraid it was. As you say, there's a question mark. We're questioning, first, whether it's higher, and second, whether it's education. And our answer to both is no. Yes, Claudia and I are on the left. I guess we can admit that.
Okay.
And even though we no longer have tenure, but still, we'll still admit to that. But we looked at this matter of, yes, tenure, lifetime employment. And we said, left, right, it doesn't matter. We're talking about 60-year-old men, mainly, who are making $100,000 salaries and continuing this with tenure. They can stay till they're 90 if they want. And I said, left or right, that's got to go.
Let me get your opinion on one of the things that bothers the right so much. I know it bothers me, and that is that in financial uncertainty like today, and the University of California system is in real trouble and cutting a lot of classes and firing a lot of people. And yet the diversity monster, all those people, dozens and dozens of people on each campus who are diversity officials, why aren't some of those cut? Why is it so sacrosanct?
Well, John, we're less concerned with, let's say, the diversity officers. Oh, there are a lot of them, and I've met lots of them. But they are far outweighed by, let's say, the psychological counselors. You've got, at Williams College, a full-time person dealing with eating disorders.
Wow.
In other words, Columbia University has an anti-smoking office.
Oh. Now, big staff too, I think.
Of course, and with a secretary, with an assistant, and a travel budget to go to the national international meeting on smoking disorders.
Right.
It's the generic or the general, what should we say, administrative apparatus that bothers us, because every new smoking person you have means one less associate professor of philosophy.
Well, now that you've laid out the general problem of universities today, can you tell us in 2 minutes or less how you're going to solve them?
The biggest problem for us is the cost. I mean, this is outrageous.
Nearing 50,000.
50,000, that's just the beginning for tuition, room, and board. There are going to be fees, travel, not to mention maybe that summer or semester in Padua, which is going to cost a bit more. How can we bring this down? Wow. You know, at one point, our president, whom I support, suggested we've got to put a lid on higher education costs. The head of their chief lobby, the American Council of Education, said, oh my, that's going to be price controls. Well, you know what, John? I'm in favor of price controls. Yeah.
It doesn't always work, though.
Hey.
Did it work under Nixon? No.
Well, it worked during World War II.
I see. Okay, I'm afraid that we have no more time, and this has been an unusually good interview here, and I'd like to print it out so we can run the text along with the podcast. Thank you very much, Andrew Hacker, for being with us today.
Well, John, I've enjoyed this too.
Thank you.